Hey, and welcome to the Hashtag Angels podcast, where we bring you conversations about the latest tech trends with the people inventing and shaping them. I'm Jessica Varelli, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, April Underwood.
I have learned to be able to like manage having a job, sometimes showering.
And Chloe Sladen.
Sounds a little woohoo and hippie, which is why I guess I'm living in Bolinas now.
And we are catching up with Seema Sistani.
I mean, I feel like it's like not the right thing to say, but it's like, nope. I worked hard, I was prepared, and when shit came my way, I could grab it.
Seema is the CEO and co-founder of House Party, a face-to-face social network that was acquired by Epic Games. Today, we deep dive into a bunch of personal topics, like identity changes and societal expectations when you become a parent. Then we talk about Seema's experience leading House Party during COVID, and the whole group's experience of becoming founders in their 40s. All right, let's jump in.
Just goes to show how hard your 30s can be.
It was my toughest decade.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like super hard losing some part of like your single self.
Mm-hmm. It's a total reinvention. It's like you have to recreate yourself.
Totally.
As a parent, a partner.
I also feel like I had really high expectations of how I was going to be as a parent and a partner. You know, it's... expectations, I feel like, are really just a way to fail yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to now think a lot about like, my best is good enough. My best is good enough because mm-hmm. I'm just an aspirational type A person by nature. It's impossible. It was like at the beginning of COVID when I was like, we've got this. Here's my whiteboard. And I've got, and this is how everything's going to work out. And it's like, you know, 2 weeks in, I'm miserable. Happy hour is getting an hour earlier every day. And finally, it's like, fuck the whiteboard. Like, we're all having screen time. We're all eating sugar. I don't care what it takes.
Mm, yeah.
I think it's the silver lining of COVID is it's forced so many people, and maybe moms in particular, to completely deconstruct this myth of the working mother, the sort of doing it all. And even though we're allowed to recognize it's hard, we don't, you know, it's hard to take away 50 years worth of work trying to say like, you can, you know, be an earner and be a great mom and still have friends and a life and mental health. And
well, I've got a theory on some of this, which is that dudes... this is a huge generalization, but many of them have seen a model of fatherhood, which is not super involved and is not doing meal planning and is not doing a lot of the things that a lot of us, you know, expect from or hope to get partnership from our partners on. But like every day, a dad in 2020 is probably so much better than a dad 40 years ago. And meanwhile, for women, we've taken on so many more roles, and we have this model which is based in moms that oftentimes were completely dedicated to the household. And so we're always, you know, we are, you know, frankly, we just have fewer hours in the day to do what the model was sort of set for us. And so, you know, if you've got two people living in a household sharing responsibilities, one person is like, I am crushing it. Like, I am so much better than the generation before me. And the other person is like, I am failing at this because I'm so much worse than the generation before me. Like, man, that's a lot to put on a marriage, right?
That's so true.
That's crazy. Yeah. I actually never thought about it that way. And I think only because my mother... She worked, went to school, immigrated to this country and had to do all of that and actually earned her PhD when I graduated from Duke with my undergrad degree.
Badass.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, she's a total badass. And now she's the chair of her department.
Come on.
And but that, I think, even more so made me feel like a striver.
Mm. Yeah.
What is your mom's expectation for you?
Oh my God, Chloe, to be happy. And she says it all the time, and you're hilarious to bring that up. Because whenever I'm stressed, she's like, I just want you to be happy.
And do you ever talk to her about her Herculean efforts, what she achieved, which is literally everything? I mean, learning a new culture, language, having children, reaching the top of her field, working, earning money, being a present parent.
Not in so many words, but... It's interesting. So she was here for 3 months when like I had my second child. to help me out because I had to go right back into it. I was, you know, we were in the depths of House Party, and I really needed the support. And she could just see I was so stressed, and I was trying to do all of these different things. And I remember she sat me down and she was like, "You're doing this to yourself. Like, if you want, I understand you want to build this thing. You're excited about it. And you're also trying to do lean on this front." And she was the one who put into my mind this idea of like, there is no such thing as balance. Like, it's okay that some days you're going to be a really good mom. And it's okay that on like those days or those weeks, you probably, your work will suffer. And then there will be times where you're just killing it at work and you're going to have to ask for help from Alex and from myself and from, you know, and you're blessed, you can afford help. And you're not going to feel like a great mom, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. And I think what she was really trying to drive to me in that moment when I was putting so much pressure on myself, and you guys know, and I've been open about this, I miscarried twice between my two kids, and, you know, still think it had a lot to do with the stress, but like and this is why we're in our 40s and we're feeling much better. But like at that point, it was, yes, there are the external pressures, but the person putting pressure on was myself. I'm putting pressure on me. I'm creating an expectation that is impossible to reach.
And of course, that's how you end up running a huge, important social network. So it's sort of like, that pressure you put on yourself is like why we're all here today. So it's effective. So it's kind of a hell of a drug in a way, but figuring out when to use it and when to let it go is the trick, right?
Well said.
One essential skill I feel as a parent that we have to teach our children is, how do you strengthen your internal sense of self so much that when the world pressures you for not doing things the way they expect, that doesn't affect your sense of worth, self, drive, direction. Like, how do you build that interior strength for our children, whatever that choice is for them? It may be being a full-time parent.
Yeah.
Like, how do we build that fortitude that the kids just know who they are and how they want to be in the world despite how the world tells them they should be?
Well, that's the thing. There's not a right choice. And so instilling a sense in kids that there's like one right way, that's not it. It's like helping them figure out how to make their own choice. And that's what I love about the story that you shared with us about that conversation you had with your mom, Seema. It's like, how amazing is that to have, you know, especially as an adult, have a relationship with a parent that can help give you that counsel on how to like sort of look inward and trust your instincts and like and make the choice that's right for you, because there's never a right one. And there's a million of those choices to make every day. So I love that. I want to meet your mom.
Me too. Yeah, me too. I also love just the grace that you've been able to give yourself.
Well, and I want to hear how that's showing up and how you're leading your team right now, Seema. So maybe as a primer, will you tell us about House Party and what's been going on? And then maybe we can hear a little bit about how you bring some of that same sort of mindset to the way that you lead your organization these days.
Well, we created it to be the most human way to be together when you're physically apart. And, you know, perfect transition, right? We've never been more physically apart than we have this year. And, you know, I think that a lot of people might think of it as group video chat. We really consider House Party to be a face-to-face social network. You decide who your friend group is in advance. You can quickly open the app and start a, you know, video chat. And, you know, I think that part is actually really worth repeating, because there are a lot of different ways to video chat. And what we do differently is attach video conversation to a friend graph, so that you have this ambient awareness of your friend's status, the same way we used to use, you know, AOL AIM, like Messenger. You could set your status and it'd be green or red. You know, when a House Party notification gets sent out, Seema's in the house, you know, my brother, who's 10 years younger than me, if he's in between his rounds, he might just pick it up and just say, "Hey, what's up?" Like, there's no baggage. There's no hurdles for our, like, no agenda. If I call him, he's picking up the phone. What's wrong? You know? And I think that that's the, like, the big differentiator. Also, we have native games and experiences. So, you know, everything from trivia to karaoke. So there's fun things to do to sort of lubricate the conversation, just the same way you would if you were IRL in your living room and you wanted to have a game night. And in terms of this year, like I couldn't be more proud of what this team has achieved, because House Party went from being this place for spontaneous togetherness to really a lifeline. And a lot of people had used it as a way to stay connected. But, you know, when it's actually started more like in mid-February, we started to really see this growth. And we were getting all this feedback that this is the way that I'm talking to my grandmother. I can't see her. This is the way that, you know, I'm meeting my grandchild. I have a friend in the hospital. This is how we're staying connected. Gender reveals, proposals, and, you know, obviously still the fun stuff, happy hours, game nights, all happening on House Party. And so the whole team had to support this insane growth at a time when, as humans, we were the least supported. Mm. We were able to quickly evolve to a work from home culture, like building video chat solutions, seriously catalyzed our ability to have a work from home culture. But everybody, I think, was suffering some level of mental health and exhaustion ish, you know. And, you know, the moment that I scratched that whiteboard up, I also said, guys, you know, it's like, okay, every other Fridays we're off. And the Friday that we're not off, it's, you know, no meetings. And, you know, if you need to have some sort of flexibility in the hours that you work or when you work, or you can only be at 50%, that's fine. We'll figure it out. We put mandatory walk times, lunch times, like just so people would take time for themselves, because I don't know about you guys, but it's super easy to just wake up, go to your desk, and suddenly find yourself there all day.
Mm-hmm. Mandatory walk times is amazing.
So it's, again, it's just trying to lead by example. Mm-hmm. I think that being a parent is one of the blessings, is it reminds you what's important. And I happen to have a brother who I mentioned before is 10 years younger, who is a doctor on the front lines. And I kept reminding everybody that, like, what we're doing is important, but we're not literally saving lives. So like, remember that when you're getting worked up, remember that when you're getting stressed.
Mm-hmm. Will you tell us a little bit about that co-founder and CEO journey through different stages, especially starting in that early phase of trying to bring something to life from nothing?
I was brought up to take on a more traditional path. Like, my parents were like, you're going to be a doctor or a lawyer. And thankfully, my brother went down the doctor path, but I fully disappointed them. You know, they wanted us to do something secure and safe. And much to their chagrin, on the day before I was supposed to take the LSAT, I pulled the plug and decided I wanted to do something different. And, like, between having a high tolerance for risk and stars in my eyes, like, you know, there's some combination of that plus determination that made me fall into entrepreneurship. And so, you know, the idea for House Party was really to bring empathy back to online communication. We wanted to get away from the highlight reel and bring back more authentic communications online. I don't know if you can see this, like, on my back of my phone, I have this, like, warning: social media seriously harms your mental health. And I believe that. I feel like it's creating a lot of angst and loneliness, and what I felt like would be really exciting and great to build is something that's going to bring us back to that initial promise of social networks, which was, like, to connect you to the people you care about most. And somewhere along the line, social networks evolved to social media. Mm. And so social media uses algorithms, maximize user engagement. There's surveillance of user activity to maximize revenue and target advertising. And that's just led to networks becoming more toxic and controversial. And so our hope was we could build back something that was a positive social communication based on small groups of friends, and a medium that really promotes empathy and playfulness. And anyways, coming back to the whole being a founder or CEO during, you know, as part of that. That's like, I feel like I just wanted to build this thing, and I was super, super excited and super passionate about it. And so I surrounded myself with other people who felt the same way, and they surrounded themselves with other people who felt the same way. And we just wanted to do something really that we could be proud of.
Yeah.
And I think part of that also defines who I am as a leader, which is to say that I'm just trying to do the right thing. Just trying to make the right decisions. And I don't always make the right decisions. I don't always make the right calls. But because of that, I'm willing to admit when I'm wrong. And I'm trying to learn from others on the team who know things better than I do.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
As a woman in her 40s with two kids and happens to be a person of color, like, looks a little different than what else is out there.
Yeah, it really, I just want to validate that. Yes, it does. I mean, even the idea that as the CEO, as the leader of this organization, that there's things to learn from the people in your organization. I just think that's a level of maturity as a leader that, you know, people aren't often born with. And so it gets developed sort of, you know, it gets developed with experience. So I think that's a huge advantage for you. It's awesome to see.
Were there moments in that journey that felt pivotal or transformational in risks you took that have set you up to become the executive and the leader you are now?
Oh my gosh, so many. Is it that Oprah quote that's like preparation, like luck is preparation meeting opportunity? You know, I consider myself to be a really hard worker and versatile. And so when the right opportunity showed up, I was able to like move into it. I mean, I feel like it's like not the right thing to say, but it's like, no, I worked hard. I was prepared. And when shit came my way, I could grab it. And so the pivotal moment is kind of a weird one, actually. It's like, so you mentioned I was at Goldman Sachs after I graduated college. And I had this great mentor there who told me, his name is Ken McTamney. I hope he hears this. And he told me, work takes up more of your life than anything else you do. Like being with family, sleeping, like having fun, anything is work. So you better fucking love it. And it meant, that was like a mind-blowing concept to me. Here I found myself on the equities trading floor of Goldman. But honestly, like it wasn't something I was passionate about. It seemed like the right thing, and I got a great paycheck, and I was working with really, really, really talented, awesome people. But what I found myself every morning waking up was like, I loved reading about like Variety and the Hollywood Reporter, not necessarily the Wall Street Journal. And this was a time when Time Warner AOL was merging, Vivendi Universal was imploding. Like there was just all of this stuff happening in media, and I was focused in on it. I was so excited about it. And I just happened to, that year, have planned a road trip with a girlfriend of mine in California. And we were going to drive from San Francisco to San Diego. And we stopped in LA where I visited a friend of mine, Grant Kessman. Again, I hope he listens to this. And he was working at a celebrity management firm at the time. It was called The Firm. And he was telling me all about his job there. And I was like, God, this is like the dream. But like, it never occurred to me to even like Hollywood. Like, I can't do that. I don't have connections there. I grew up in Alabama to like Persian parents. Like, what do I even know about that? And so he handed me all these scripts so I could read on my flight back. But the way they do it, they pull the covers off because they're not produced yet. And so that's like how you keep the confidentiality. So I was reading this one. I threw all of the scripts out. I kept one, and I'm reading that script on the plane. And I was like so moved by this story. And I just thought, this is what I want to be doing. I want to be telling stories. I want to be building something. This is so awesome. He's going to make this thing happen. I'm so jealous. The next morning, I'm on my way to Goldman. I was taking the bus, so it's not my usual thing. I was sitting next to a person. Again, usually I have the Wall Street Journal, but I had forgotten it that morning. So I'm sitting next to a woman. I'm reading over her shoulder. She's got a book in her hand. I'm like reading a passage. I'm like, wait, I read that passage in the script last night. And I look at her. I said, what's the name of that book? And she was like, The House of Sand and Fog. And I was like, oh my God. I call my friend as soon as I get to work. Hey, was the script you gave me The House of Sand and Fog? And he was like, yeah, it's going to be a movie with Ben Kingsley, Shor Ahadashlu. Like, she ended up winning an Oscar for that role. I was like, this is a sign. Like, this is me in my early 20s, right? This is a sign.
This is a sign.
I should be out there.
Yeah. There was no CoStar app then to tell you that it was a sign. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I literally quit my job that month and I moved out to LA.
Love it.
Because I love it. I was convinced. I was convinced that the world had come together in all of these crazy ways to tell me that you know what? You could do it. You can go out there. And that's what led me to CAA. That's what led me to media, like properly getting like sort of my, if you will, that my MBA in media in Hollywood, which was at working at a talent agency. Like that, if that hadn't happened, maybe I'd be a managing director at Goldman right now. I don't know.
And it's just fascinating because now is your CEO of House Party, a major consumer social product. And we're seeing in the industry, you know, media and creator economies and influencers are now at the center of a lot of consumer technology and products. Now it's so clear how those different threads would set you up to be innovating at House Party.
Oh, yeah. I was just giving my parents like one heart attack after another this whole time. But in hindsight, I'm just like, yeah, my media background inspired me around shared experiences. Like I learned about creating powerful platforms and connecting people globally through content. I've learned about good social norms and positive interactions from my experience at Tumblr. There's a through line.
I love it.
I love Manifest Destiny.
I'm going to flip the script a little bit and see, you know, April and Chloe have also taken the leap in the last year or two to leave larger companies, take a little bit of time off, but then get back to building and have both started companies. Did either of you in that journey have a moment, like a specific memory when you realized like, this is that moment for the next chapter of my life's work is to get back to building and found something?
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, honestly, it was, it was right here in this room because this, you know, I'm sitting at home right now. And I had spent a lot of my time since leaving Slack, where I'd been the chief product officer. You know, I'd been doing some angel investing, and then I did one advisory gig, and I loved it. I worked with the CEO, and he had me come in and help him think about some things around how to scale the product organization. And suddenly, like those muscles, like the wheels started turning again after like giving them a little bit of a break. And I was like, oh yeah, I like doing the work. You know, I like to dive in and like tease these problems apart and actually like take something from point A to point B. And so, you know, I'd had these little breadcrumbs, but honestly, you know, when shelter in place hit and I was primarily focused on investing at that point, I was sitting in this room and I was like, what do I have the ability to do that I am like, I'm really lucky and in like very rare company to be able to do, and which is like, I can actually start a company from this room. You know, I know really talented people that I want to work with again, that want to work with me. I see problems and an opportunity that I think like is very, very timely. And I think it's a hard thing, but I think that we can actually do it. And I'm lucky enough to have built a set of people throughout my career that, you know, are up for backing me. And like, and it's like, so, I mean, talk about like hashtag blessed. I mean, like it's such a confluence of things to have that opportunity. It's so hard to start a company. It's so hard to raise money. It's so hard to build a team. But I'm 40 and I've been working at this for a long time. And I've spent Seema said, you know, I've been doing the work. I've been planting the seeds. And so now I have all the pieces. And for me, the light turned back on. But also, I don't have any trouble like getting out of bed in the morning and jumping into the seat because I'm so excited about what I'm doing. And what a gift to like get those moments of joy through my work during a like really hard year.
It's funny because we have this image of founders, the old image of founders are, you know, men in their 20s. And I don't know if I were in my 20s today, maybe my journey would be different, but similar to April, you know, I was in my 40s when I founded my company. And for me, the journey was I left Twitter in 2014 And as soon as I left Twitter, I knew that whatever I was doing next, I wanted to build my own thing. I think it was just, you know, 20 years of hard work building other people's companies and loving it and believing those visions, but it was my turn. In many ways, I think being a founder in your 40s is amazing. You actually have management experience, operational experience. You're not making it all up as you go along. But for that, you know, the passion and the vision to find product market fit is something you just have to go for. It's like there's no experience for that really, other than founding. But for me, it was 2014 to 2019 when my co-founder and I officially teamed up and raised money. So in those years, I mean, that's quite a gap. You know, I'm always amazed by people who want to build something and then 6 months later have founded something. Kind of what April was able to do, basically.
6 days, 6 months.
And part of it was like you're a solo founder who's building now a really incredible team of leaders around you, which is an amazing path. But for me, I knew I needed a partner. And it was a five-year journey of having two more babies, doing a bunch of board work in the media industry at Gannett, which is USA Today and the largest largest news organization in the U.S. So, you know, that's a pretty intense time. It's a pretty intense time to be on the public board of a company at a news organization. And then angel investing with, of course, hashtag angels. But really, the true work, other than having babies, board work, and angel investing, which was all fascinating and intellectually stimulating, but really, my job was to find my partner. And just trying to meet a bunch of different people and also not hurrying it because, you know, my whole life had been, I see something I want to do and I go do it and I push boulders up mountains to do it. And this didn't feel like the right approach to find your work partner. I was just like, you know what? People who know me and know me deeply, I'm going to ask them for advice. I'm going to try and see if they have people to connect me with. But really, this is more about trying to really see just flow to see if that person will materialize.
Manifest.
Yeah, it was. Manifest. It really was. So anyhow, my amazing co-founder Ramesh did manifest, and I love working with him, and it's great. And who knows where we'll go? But I love my work. I love it so much.
I saw this Paul Graham tweet the other day. I didn't interact with it on Twitter, but I'll interact with it here on this pod.
I can't wait to hear which one this is going to be.
It says, at what age, when you choose to defer starting a startup because you need to get more experience, does the probability that you're lying yourself cross 50%?
Ugh.
Jessica thought 26. I thought 24, but somewhere in the mid-20s probably. So I couldn't figure out the tweet to respond to this. I think Chloe and I are definitely in like the 99th percentile or something based on that rubric. But anyway, I don't know about all that.
This is so infuriating because YC sets the precedent for what it takes to be a startup leader.
Totally.
And it is so myopic that the founder of YC is prizing people in their mid-20s because, and I quote, stamina, poverty, rootlessness, colleagues, and ignorance. I remember that because I put it in a blog post once about how much that stacks the chips against someone, because when I was 37 when, you know, taking on this journey, but it basically says like, you're not worth it. And it implies there's only one way to be successful. And it's like, okay, Silicon Valley, let me offer up another point of view that like, maybe if you have had all this experience and you are able to, you know, be later in life where actually it's riskier. It's harder to take that leap of faith. And you're taking that leap of faith on yourself, then fucking listen.
Mm-hmm. Amen. And you know what? You're proving the exception, which I put in air quotes, because whatever. But I mean, your success is everybody's success who's deciding, you know what, like it took me a long time to get to this point to decide to start something, but now I'm going to do it. And there's reasons, you know, there's a lot of reasons why a lot of people have been either in a position where it was actually wise for them to be more oriented towards safety and security, or they've just been attenuated towards it. But I mean, if this industry can be one in which people can decide to make that leap at 30 or 40 or 50, like that's awesome. And I'm here for it. Also literally here for it. Like
right here.
Is there something in your life that, something that emboldened you to feel comfortable taking these swings and carrying on this path?
You know, it's having a partner, a family, friends who are so supportive to where you can take risks and know if you fall flat on your face, you have people who are going to help pick you up. I mean, that's, I don't take that lightly. That's real, and it's lucky, and it's privileged. It's not lucky, it's privileged. And so I just want to put that out there and not take that for granted. Mm. But going back to, like, if we're going back to our mantras and stuff, is a little bit of like, I give less fucks. That's a very flippant way, but like, it emboldens you. What's the worst that can happen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I really want to know what has emboldened you guys, because especially, I mean, I thought April, Chloe, right now, I mean, you've achieved a lot, both like professionally, economically. Like, there was, you didn't have to move into this world to building something again. And something's emboldened you. There's some, you know, foundation there that is pushing you in that direction. Like, what is that?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a few things. I mean, first and foremost, it was the realization that I could put what I know to use for a bunch of people that are just getting underserved by the tech community, namely small business owners. Like, you know, by and large, software is not really being built for that audience, like mom and pop shops. And they're getting left behind. And I know how to, I've got some ideas about how to do something about that. So like, I feel motivated by that because it's a problem I want to get up and solve every day. Cause like, I care about the community that I'm in, and I care about other people being able to be part of thriving communities. And like, communities can't thrive if there's not a healthy business community that supports the residents in that community. And so like, so I just, you know, I found a problem that I've sort of always cared about and in a sense for how to do it. And so, but the emboldening part was more like a sense of like, oh yeah, like I know how to do this, and I actually like building software. And I think that when you lead, you know, when you're leading large teams, when you get further and further away from like the craft of the work because of the nature of your job, it can get a little cloudy. You know, I mean, there are so many things I loved about my role at Slack, so many things I loved about my role at Twitter, but they weren't the day in, day out of like building software. And so, you know, coming back to that and having, probably being freed from a sense that I need to be successful at it actually gives me, like, emboldens me to like go and just do it well without like the shackles of like, I don't know, some sort of perf system or some promotion ladder or whatever, like in front of me, but like, just go do it the best that I can. And it is a little sad to like be at 20 years into this industry and to like decide, I think I'm going to do this because I actually think it would be fun. And I've had a lot of fun along the way, but I wouldn't say that I was emboldened by the idea of doing it because it was fun. I was doing it because I was trying to do it well, and I was trying to be successful in those sorts of things. And I think that showed up in some of my leadership style at times, in good ways, and also in ways that I think I can improve upon. And so, yeah, it is a gift to be able to like go build something just because you want to. I mean, kind of like, it sounds like how you started House Party.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah. Building software is fun.
Oh my God, it's so fun.
I mean, building stuff and getting it into the hands of people and seeing them actually use it. Like, it's, yeah, we're in like, I mean, not a lot of people get to do that. I mean, on the planet get to do that. Everyone theoretically could do it, but like, get to do it at scale is really rare. So I don't take it for granted, but I did probably for a long time.
I think what emboldened me was, I noticed in my career that I could see a little tiny component of the future. I would literally get this internal vibration around things, like Twitter, for instance, when I was working at Current TV. And back then, I didn't know to trust that sense that you're feeling change ahead of everyone else and move towards it, right? Like, I just knew I wanted that job. I could see how Twitter was going to be the interactive TV platform we've been talking about for 20, 30 years, which was my profession and area and space. And I think as I got older, this is where, again, ego comes in. Like, you know, how do you have enough ego to believe in yourself? But sometimes experience means that you realize, oh, yeah, yeah, no, that's what you should listen to. That's not just a tingling. That's a connection to something. So now for me, it was like believing, like I can feel sometimes, and it doesn't happen often in my life, very rare, but I can feel this vibration. I can see or sense something that's coming. And if I can just tap into that energy and use my other energy of like just making shit happen, that there's something there. And then for me, that coincided with becoming a parent, which has been so fascinating as such a challenging experience that most of the world gets to go through, and is the most profound impact you leave for most people, right? If you're not running a, you know, parish, or you're not CEO of a company, or you're not like, you know, not everyone gets to run their community or be the, you know, the principal of a school or something, but many people get to have kids, and those kids are literally the world, the next experience the world goes through. And it's so hard and getting harder because of all these complex things that I want to go into now, but are, you know, part of our startup. And so to me, it was like this perfect blend of trust that sense that you get that is an energy force, trust that, you know, you're relentless. And then as a trained anthropologist, and anthropology is always what I've always loved, you know, my passion is how people connect. And those things all came together around parenting, connection, and feeling where technology, energy, and change is coming from. Sounds a little woohoo and hippie, which is why I guess I'm living in Bolinas now. But yeah, it was just, I think it was a, you know, it's timing and then just learning to trust yourself. And it kind of brings me to a question for you, Seema, around, you know, and I think April and I are both in this stage where we have prototypes, where we have this vision, we have a mission, we have our needs finding, we have our research, we have this impact we want to have. And I call it this, like, there's a phase where you're just wandering in the woods. You know, the product isn't showing itself to you yet. You know what it wants, you want it to feel like, but you haven't figured out the ways it fits together.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do want to say though that you mentioned your like that inkling or that vibration that you get, mm-hmm. and I hear that a lot about creation stories. Mm. That there is literally like electrical impulses that can draw vision towards you, and I believe that. And I mean, if you follow mindfulness, people say like gratitude, you know, helps you uncover that. Mm. I mean, that's like, we're getting woohoo again, but.
Oh, I love that.
I follow the feels a lot in life. Mm-hmm. I do let that guide me. But if I'm being honest about the question that you're asking, it was the on the ground element of when we were just trying to execute and push something through. And the thing that energized everybody was the feedback loop that we were getting with the people who were trying the app, the users. So I feel like the early behaviors that really gave us conviction were around word of mouth. We were on the ground. We'd seed the app, and for us, it was campuses, and it was campuses because of density. We felt like the density of the population really made it a good venue to learn from. And you know, we would see like we'd plant the seed. Yes, so we'd go out there, we'd talk to people, we'd ask them to use it, but like, oh, what? Wait, it's spreading. It's spreading and we didn't do anything. This is all organic. This is amazing. And we go talk to those users. Why are you spreading it? What do you love about it? And that actually like feeds the creation story. And then outside of that, it also drives the creation story because ultimately the data would show, oh, look, it's like moving from Ohio to Michigan. Let's go talk to the Michigan folks. And then let's like work on seeding it further.
Yeah, I mean, I am in it right now because we launched our first pilot for our local laboratory 3 weeks ago in Oakland. It's a site called keepoaklandalive.com, and you can shop in a bunch of local stores in one place and get it delivered to your house. But like, it's so early that like, you know, we read every tweet as a team, you know, every, you know, if somebody sends me a screenshot of people talking about it on Nextdoor, it's like, it makes our day. And so, I mean, it's like a narrow window when each human interaction like really, like, it carries a lot of weight.
Mm-hmm. We're going to switch into our lightning round. I'm going to fire off a handful of short questions, and I'd love to hear your answer.
Da-da-da-da-da-da. I love game shows. It feels like a game show. Da-da-da-da-da-da. I was like, sorry, that's the music.
There you go. It's good. It's good.
Something you have learned to do during COVID.
Okay, well, there's a serious one and there's a fun one, which is the serious one is family dinners. We were terrible at that. Like Alex and I both commute. We work in the city and we live in Menlo Park. And so it was always one or the other, and we were ships passing. And so now we have gotten into a habit of sitting down and having family dinners. And I, the silver lining of all this is I think we're all getting some good new habits. And that is a good new habit that I will maintain. And then on the other side is I've also learned a new cocktail every week. So my latest one is a Moscow Mule, and that's pretty fun. How about you guys?
I've cooked more in the past, 6 months or whatever, than I have my entire life combined. I feel like a pioneer woman at times, but I have learned to be able to like manage having a job, sometimes showering, and like keeping like frozen meat, like cycling through the refrigerator. Like that was like a next level skill of like a process that like you kick off on Sunday for Tuesday's dinner. And I'm just like so impressed with myself every time I'm able to eat something that was at one point frozen, which I had not done for the first 39 years of my life.
So I've learned to cook Indian food. Some Indian food, thanks to my co-founder's mother-in-law leaving me with two bags of real Indian spices. And then I was like, I miss her cooking. She came to live with him for a few months while he had a second child. And so I just started cooking Indian food and I love it. Meanwhile, by the way, my husband is making homemade yogurt and today he started making homemade almond milk.
Wow.
Which is pretty frontiersy.
Wow.
Love it. Someone amazing we should all know.
I've met a lot of really great new people. Where am I going to settle? Martha Lane Fox.
She's on the Twitter board.
Yes. And she's fascinating. And she started Last Minute, which was a very big deal in Europe, travel company. And she's just a fascinating woman. And I love meeting and getting to know her. So somebody we should all know.
Jess.
I have started working pretty closely with Molly Graham. Molly became the COO at Lambda School. And it's just been so awesome to see those really great pairs between a founder, a CEO, and a COO when they trust each other, when they complement one another in terms of skill sets and expertise.
I've been so heads down with three kids, none of whom are in school, in-person learning, cooking, repairing dishwashers, and trying to pivot our startup, that the person I would recommend, I wish everyone spent time with, that I've been spending more time with, is your local public school board. Because those folks who, in the case of my local public school, are all volunteers, and especially during coronavirus and the extraordinary things we're asking our school districts to do, it's just phenomenal and they need more community support. So, at least in our town, I don't know if this is true everywhere, those board meetings are public, open, transparent. Show up, cheer them on, lend your support, especially if you're a tech person, because connectivity is such a big issue these days. Those are the unsung heroes right now for me.
Right on. Great answer, Chloe. And with that, I think we're going to wrap up. Seema, thank you so much for joining us. This was just such a treat to be here with you.
Yeah, we did it.
Mm-hmm. That's a wrap. Thank you for listening. To keep up with Seema, you can follow her on Twitter. She's at Seema Sistani. Next up on the pod, we catch up with Maya Bittner, co-founder of Pinch, which was acquired by Chime. We talk about why fintech fascinates her, her fintech book club, and how selling old cameras on eBay got her hooked on entrepreneurship. If you're enjoying the pod, please give us a rating or leave us a review. Since we're new around here, this really helps people discover us. The Hashtag Angels podcast is a production of H Industries. The episode was produced and edited by Matt Herrero, and our theme music was composed by Toby Forsman of Whipsong Music. Thank you for listening, and we will see you soon.